What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
I also want to talk to you about Venezuela. An investigation by the New York Times found several trucks carrying so-called humanitarian aid that were set ablaze during a showdown at the Colombia-Venezuela border last month were not caused by President Nicolas Maduro's forces, as was widely reported at the time by both media and Trump administration officials. This is Vice President Mike Pence.
Maduro's loyalists turned on their own people. As the world watched, they set fire to trucks loaded with food and medicine desperately needed by the Venezuelan people.
Independent journalist Max Blumenthal first raised questions about what happened in a piece on February 24th that was headlined Burning Aid, Interventionist Deception on Colombia-Venezuela Bridge.
Max Blumenthal, really excited to be talking to you. Love having you on the show.
Love being on the show every once in a while.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Yeah.
When was the last time I was on the show?
Oh, wait, you have headphones so I don't get the echo?
Yeah, but I'm speaking into a microphone.
That's okay. In other words, because you don't have headphones, my audio.
Yeah, I can do it. I can do it. It's okay.
All right, thanks.
If you want.
I love that Max makes the most like quotidian, mundane tasks sound like he's rescuing someone from the top of a mountain or something. If you need me to do it, I'll do it.
I can do it. There's a child up there.
Yeah.
All right, I can do it.
So one of the reasons I'm really excited to talk to you is because you're kind of a unique authority right now in two things that are happening. One is what's happening in Venezuela, and the other thing is what's happening with all the mishigas with Ilhan Omar and Israel. And of course, all the stuff we're not talking about because we're talking about Ilhan Omar, which is all the stuff in Israel. So which one do you want to start with?
Well, I've just been in Venezuela, and I've also been a Jew who was number four on the Simon Wiesenthal top anti-Semites list.
Did that give you an inferiority complex because you weren't top three? You didn't even make bronze.
I always say next year I'll outdo the Ayatollah.
Next year in Jerusalem, yeah.
They always put some Iranian guy at number one because, I don't know, I guess they don't want Israel doesn't want to bomb me.
Right. At least with not as much enthusiasm with which they want to bomb Iran.
Yeah, I mean, they would bomb me, but Iran is more of a priority.
Right. Yeah, bad optics if they bomb you also.
If directly, yeah.
So, okay, which way do you want to go? This is like a rabbinical thing. Which way we have...
Well, you're the host.
I knew you were going to say that. All right, so, fine. So why don't we start with... I know, burn from both of us. Why don't we start with Venezuela? Just give a little summary on what's going on with Venezuela.
Well, right now, there's a major electricity blackout, which the Venezuelan government is blaming on sabotage. I don't know if it's sabotage or not, but to see U.S. officials and lawmakers like Marco Rubio, who's really the biggest loudmouth on the coup, celebrate it really shows Venezuelans what U.S. leadership wants for them, which is that regardless of their political stripes or how they feel about the government, the U.S. is happy to see them suffer as long as it advances regime change. You know, there is a blackout, and while we're not sure if it's sabotage, I can say for sure that last week, food warehouse where free food that's basically distributed for free to Venezuelans, to the working and poor Venezuelan population by the government, was burned down, probably by the opposition. Thousands of boxes of food were destroyed. Oh, the week before, oil extraction facilities were attacked and with explosives on Venezuela's coast. And there's just a long history of opposition sabotage. Maternity ward was burned in 2017, along with food warehouses. And the U.S. has a history of sabotaging the electricity grids and electrical infrastructure of countries it's targeted for regime change. Most notably, a month before, Salvador Allende was killed. That took place in Chile in the middle of an Allende speech, a massive blackout. So,
and then, of course, they helped kill him during the coup. The CIA supported the coup.
Absolutely. And Pinochet's party recently endorsed Juan Guaido, the U.S. self-appointed puppet leader of Venezuela.
And in case listeners don't know, Pinochet was a dictator of Chile who really was a trailblazer in a lot of torture methods. So replaced the democratically elected Allende, overthrew him. Yeah.
Yeah, the helicopter. A lot of stuff. Whatever they did to Victor Jara, breaking his hands and so on. Anyway, there's a coup underway, and it's not really – I actually watched it fall apart with my own eyes. It's failed completely. It started on January 22nd when Mike Pence called Juan Guaido and said, you know, can you do this? We want to appoint you as president. Like 500 military flipped out of something like 300,000. Mike Pence is now furious, according to this Argentinian report, that Guaido misled him. They thought it was going to be a cakewalk. Plan A completely failed. They went to Plan B, which is to ram the humanitarian aid through on February 23rd. And you remember they had the Battle of the Bands with Richard Branson's ridiculous Live Aid concert. Peter Gabriel actually pulled out of it. Branson said he wanted to raise $100 million, and he raised like $2 million. And I think all of these like Colombian trash pop acts each got paid $2 million. So it was just a sham.
Right.
And, you know, that really failed to produce the escalation. I thought they were going to try to like say, oh, Maduro, like stop the aid and now we need to intervene because he's so cruel. But that didn't happen. So that failed to happen. And now we're at Plan C, which is, you know, electricity slowly being restored around Caracas. I'm not there anymore. But the U.S. doesn't really have a clear plan of action beyond sanctions. And so they're going to sanction everyone from Maduro on down to his dog. They just sanctioned the economics minister today or like put out a warrant for his arrest. They're just going crazy with sanctions. They withdrew the visas of 77 officials. And it's very clear that sanctions will deepen the economic hardship, which is real. And at the same time, there was a really interesting hearing packed with Venezuelan exiles and Cuban exiles and had two experts. One of them was a guy from the Council on the Americas, which is a corporate roundtable for Latin America. And they basically front these experts like this guy, Eric Farnsworth, who just rattles off every regime change talking point you can think of. But he's basically acting on behalf of their corporate board, which is like Exxon, Chevron, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and the financial industry that wants to get its their talons back into Venezuela. So you know where he's coming from. And then they had this lady from the Woodrow Wilson Center, which is funded by the U.S. government. And she was a little bit more moderate than Farnsworth and actually started arguing with Rubio and said, you know, well, first of all, Rubio said we need widespread unrest as a strategy to promote regime change, you know, violent riots. And she said, you know, widespread unrest, of course, that's necessary. We all recognize the need for that. However, starving people don't get out into the streets. And so I worry with these sanctions that people will be starving and will be so desperate that they won't even protest. And Rubio was pretty annoyed by that. But it's the truth. Even like the regime change experts in Congress are recognizing that sanctions are going to starve people. At the same time, I don't think that sanctions are going to cause regime change. I think the Venezuelan government has a strategy to start increasing its oil exports and to be able to receive the assets that the U.S. is trying to block with sanctions. And that means turning to other countries, which are rising powers, like China and Russia, which is a resurgent power. Turkey has been a big supporter of Venezuela. And then you have opening markets in the African Union, which has also rejected Juan Guaido and the U.S. regime change plan. And so I think we're going to have to wait and see. But Venezuela is interesting, not just because you're seeing a regime change, another regime change attempt be stymied, mm-hmm. but because we're actually kind of watching the world order shift. And that will have implications for domestic U.S. politics. You know, are people going to really support another Democratic nominee who wants to keep this kind of unipolar world order going, where we think we can just take out all the countries that oppose us? Or are people going to support someone who wants to start investing in our own infrastructure and giving humanitarian aid to our own population? So I think there's so many implications that are interesting about Venezuela that it's really worth paying attention to, even if you're not
interested. And what did you observe as someone, because you went there, how long were you there for? Where did you go? What did you see?
I was there for 2.5 weeks, mostly in Caracas, in all different areas of the city. And I went to Vargas State, which is next door, and saw nothing that could remotely be called a humanitarian crisis. It reminded me a lot of being in other Latin American countries, except the infrastructure was much better because it's a very wealthy state that, you know, whose economy revolves around oil. And they're, you know, they have highway, like a really advanced highway system. They have a metro system in Caracas that's very functional. You know, gasoline is basically free because oil is plentiful. You do have an economic crisis where the currency has been devalued. And it's not just because of socialism, like the Republicans say, 2/3 of the economy is controlled by private finance. And so, you know, there's speculation, there's a black market. I stayed in an opposition stronghold area for the last week and a half, which is an upper middle class neighborhood where people look like us. There were sushi restaurants on the corner. They had, you know, actually, I'm not even like making it up. There, you know, in the afternoon, there would be ladies walking down the street with their yoga mats.
So important. So radical self-care, Max. Radical self-care.
Yes. Really Venezuelans important. Do, you know, they have to do self-care under the communist dictatorship.
Yeah.
And, you know, behind this area actually is a barrio that's mostly Colombians who have fled Colombia, which is the U.S. protectorate, kind of our ally. And they actually prefer to live in Venezuela right now. So that's an interesting
thing
people don't know. But
maybe we should be in, you know, regime change in Colombia then.
You know, a lot of Colombians would support that. But we also supported right-wing militia, paramilitaries to prevent that from taking place. So, you know, being in this opposition stronghold, you see, I mean, I did several videos there. I did a video from a supermarket where I showed that, you know, you can get everything you want if you have the money to buy it that you can get in the U.S. It's not like there are empty shelves. And I went to a shopping mall, which was like a luxury shopping mall, and asked people, where's the socialism? Where can I find communism here? Because Trump has portrayed Venezuela as North Korea. And they said, well, that's a minority in this country. You know, we don't have that here. This is capitalism. And that's part of the problem. I mean, that's a big source of the economic crisis, is that, you know, what Chavismo has attempted to do is democratic socialism in a mixed economy and to set up their own companies to compete with these private companies. So it's much more complex than the U.S. media wants to make it out to be. Obviously, it's worse than that. I mean, the U.S. media simply invented a reality in order to advance an information war designed to push a real war. Right. And, you know, you just go around the city and it's people are going about business as usual. In 2016, the government implemented a program called CLAP, which is to distribute basic foodstuffs and sanitary and hygiene supplies.
It's ironic, the CLAP.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it like that in the coming from the U.S. and you're like, did you get the CLAP? And people were like, yes, it's a good thing.
But I'm really loving it.
Yeah.
Thank God I got it.
It's a Spanish acronym.
Yeah, of and course. CLAP.
People get these bags of like enough food for 2 weeks and toothpaste and everything, that because the black market and speculation has driven food prices so high and the salaries don't support it. So that's kept people above the subsistence level among the poorest of the population, kind of prevented them from starving. And people understand that if Juan Guaido comes in, the economic situation probably won't improve, and they will lose these basic government programs, right, along with free healthcare, along with free education, along with housing that's been supplied to 2.5 to 3 million people. And I also got to go to a housing complex that was more working class, middle class, that was established by Chavez. You know, you have to pay rent there, but it's very affordable. And it was it was like a utopia. I'm not saying that that's the situation everywhere. It's very, very dangerous. Here, families playing as it got dark, there were jogging and bike lanes. And there were this was like Jane Jacobs style mixed use commercial housing. And it was a former military base that was converted into this massive housing complex to help solve the housing crisis that existed before Chavez was in power.
And the people who don't like Maduro and who like Guaido, what is it that they object to that happens with Maduro in power?
What is it that the people who like Guaido?
Yeah, and want to remove Maduro.
There are different levels. I mean, from the middle class and upper middle class, it's that, you know, they would like to experience the oil boom that they had in the past. Under Chavez, there was an oil boom. And so they were getting second cars. They were taking long vacations. They have to take their vacations in Venezuela now, for example. There are cultural issues. They are white or light skinned, and they don't want some bus driver to be in power, which is what Maduro was. And Chavez, you know, is the son of a black woman who looks like very mestizo and very dark skinned. And, you know, they would insult him and call him like Indio and like just look down on him, even though he had a master's degree. He was a brilliant student of Venezuelan and Latin American literature and of philosophy. I mean, if you read interviews with him, it's like very clear you're dealing with someone who has so much more intellectual acumen than his opponents.
Also good at chemistry, because he was able to identify the smell of sulfur.
Definitely. In his 2006 UN speech, he detected it after Bush's speech, which preceded him.
Yesterday, the devil came here. Right here. And it smells of sulfur still today.
I'm glad you brought that up, because 2006 was like the big year in Venezuela when their economy was doing so well. The ALBA program, where they were sharing their oil wealth with other countries, was helping drive the progressive wave in Latin America. And the following year, after Chavez delivered this speech where he really came into his own as an anti-imperialist leader and was no longer just the kind of nationalist who had come out of the military. He was no longer just a patriot. He was kind of taking on the mantle of Che Guevara. The U.S. began its soft power programs of destabilization, and that's when they started training people like Juan Guaido, Leopoldo López, that's when they put in plans for these kind of Guarimba-style riots.
What's Guarimba style?
They basically blockaded off opposition areas like the one that I was living in, and then would attack police and security forces and hold protests at private universities that were bases of opposition support. Hundreds died. In a few blocks from where I was staying, a black man named Orlando Figuera was burned alive in 2017 after being identified as a Chavez supporter. And this was caught on camera. And it was a real turning point for people in Venezuela. So I talked about the cultural clash.
I didn't even know about that. And I mean, I try to be somewhat informed.
I mean, just Google Orlando Figuera.
And who was responsible for that?
Opposition protesters from what you would call the Guarimberos. Okay. It took place in Chacao, Altamira, which is an upscale area, which is the financial district of Caracas. The main opposition leader to that point, Leopoldo López, who is an aristocrat, the direct descendant of Venezuela's first president, light skin, white guy. He was the mayor. I mean, this happened under his watch. All kinds of right-wing terror happened under the watch of all of these opposition leaders. But this is the most heinous, because it was caught on camera. And it was just a black man walking down the street. And Chavista, they poured gas on him and burned him as he ran down the street. And so, you know, for people people watching that in the barrios, people watching that across the country who weren't part of this opposition bubble, they said, you know, we need to defend ourselves against these maniacs, or they're, you know, we're next. And so they kind of batten down the hatches. And so when I would go to the opposition rallies, I mean, it's just so, it's almost like a cartoon.
Can you imagine, by the way, I mean, if it had been the opposite, if a Chavez person had, or an opposition person had been burned alive, the New York Times wouldn't stop covering it. I mean, it would be front and center, every publication, every TV show, every cable news channel.
Well, the New York Times, they did this in Nicaragua, too, and like the U.S. government did it, which is that they take the whole death toll during the most violent Warimbas were 2016, 2017, Caracas on siege. With the death toll, they would just take the total number, which was in the 300s, and attribute it all to the government because they were having these,
right,
what they would call protests, but they were violent riots that would not be tolerated in the U.S. The National Guard would have been called in and people would have been shot. And they did that in Nicaragua, too, where they had the same thing. They were called tranques, where they would do road blockades, extort motorists, hold entire neighborhoods hostage and try to declare them like liberated territory by the opposition junta. You know, an 11-year-old girl was raped at one of these. A police officer who was a female unarmed police officer was raped for several days by tranquistas. God. Another police officer who was unarmed and was working with at-risk youth, Gabriel Jesus Vado, was dragged to death by a truck and then burned, had his corpse burned on camera at a tranque in the Monimbo area of Masaya. None of this was reported by U.S. media. Many cops were killed by these figures who were in their police stations. They weren't even out in the streets.
And, so the death toll includes the people killed by the opposition.
Yeah, and the U.S. media, they just say 300 were killed or however this many were killed, and it would be always blamed on the government. But over half in the Guarimbas were killed by the opposition. They used a tactic called the Huaya, where they would wrap a piece of barbed wire across a road to try to close it off, and people were beheaded.
Oh, my God.
Trying to get through the roads. And Juan Guaido was actually asked about this in 2016, about that tactic, and he called it a myth because it was his forces who were behind it. I mean, they dress him up like Obama and put him on the back of a motorcycle. He's the worst speaker I ever saw. It's like Obama without a teleprompter.
Yeah.
I mean, he's afraid of public speaking. He has the charisma of like a can of paint. And at the same time, it's deceiving. Like, his image is very deceptive because behind him are the most violent radical elements of the opposition.
And he seems kind of like a nerd almost.
Yeah, totally. He seems like a yuppie on his way to work, his little briefcase.
Right. Couldn't believe it, but I could also, that Marco Rubio, he tweeted an image of Gaddafi. And when he was bloodied, because Gaddafi, which was something that I didn't know about how he died until like a year ago. I didn't know that he was sodomized.
No, this was that picture that Rubio tweeted was while he was being sodomized. There's video evidence that a bayonet was shoved up his ass while he was basically being driven into a drainage ditch where he was going to be shot. Then they took him to a butcher shop in Misrata and left his rotting corpse on a mattress for these fanatical opposition supporters to take victory selfies with. And it's important to note that he wasn't like, it was, you know, the way that the U.S. media portrayed Gaddafi's death is that he was somehow exposed to the public and that he was, it's as if this is what the public in Libya would have done to him walking down the street. And actually he was in his hometown of Sirte, where he had launched his revolution in 1969. He was very popular there. And the U.S. had launched this brutal, NATO had launched this brutal bombing campaign of Sirte that had reduced a lot of the town center to nothing. And opposition elements, namely the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was a longtime Al-Qaeda ally, which had been armed by Qatar and supported by the U.S., was brought in as the kind of, you know, proxy force. And they attacked Gaddafi's motorcade as it attempted to flee the carpet bombing of this city. Lots of people were massacred. Bodies were found outside a hotel nearby of his supporters. And his bodyguards, who are black African Libyans, were beheaded by these fanatical Al-Qaeda allies who were actually, when they attacked his motorcade, they were being supported with NATO air power. So NATO was there bombing the front and back of Gaddafi's motorcade so that they could and proceeded to go on an anti-black pogrom across Libya, murdering black Libyans who they saw as sort of the supporters of Gaddafi who'd been protected by his government. So this is all about Rubio's tweet. Rubio thinks this is all good.
Right.
He thinks that if he tweets this, it's like, oh, I'm sending a message to scare the dictator or something. But if you're Venezuelan and you see it, you know, of course, if you support the government, you're going to be like, they're going to turn our country into Libya. Libya is hell.
Right. But do you think that it landed on – I feel like even Americans who aren't pro-Gaddafi – I mean, I don't know how – I don't see any polling. But I feel like that just came off as a terrible image. Maybe Real Jingoists embraced it. But I don't – it seems so unacceptable that a senator would post that.
Yeah, I think it should have been more – it should have been more of a scandal than Ilhan Omar, which we'll talk about.
Right.
But, you know, so many people have their – had their kind of – so many people were involved in making that moment possible in Washington. And so many people celebrated that moment in Washington, but they just kind of don't want to celebrate it. I was kind of too quiet about it at the time because I was like, oh, the Arab Spring is a good thing. You know, then I saw what happened to Gaddafi. I said, maybe Libya is fucked. Then I started learning more about it. And I have a book coming out that deals with this heavily next month called The Management of Savagery.
I have it.
Which is about the impact. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I don't know who has it or what, but it's about the kind of repercussions of U.S. regime change policy in the Middle East. And I think it applies directly to Venezuela. When Rubio does that, you know, it sabotages Elliot Abrams, who is trying to get he's trying to get the military to flip in Venezuela, and he's trying to use all these incentives. He's trying to use threats. He's trying to pay them, whatever. And then they see that they're like, okay, we're going to get killed if we defect, especially the high command. So beyond the fact that they are very patriotic, that they're nationalistic, that they hate the U.S. empire, which has destroyed so much of Latin America, the real power players in the Venezuelan military don't want to be sodomized with a bayonet.
They're weird like that.
Yeah. I don't know who I wouldn't.
It's a cultural thing. I can't relate to it. Well, you know, it's funny. It's like,
I mean, the prostate is very sensitive. I don't know.
Over there, not here.
Yeah.
Rubio also undermines Elliot Abrams in that Elliot Abrams is pretending to be doing this for democracy's sake, right? And then when you tweet out a photo that's so based in illegal violence and it's so bloody, we usually try to sanitize our operations there. But Rubio, I think it's probably partly because he's Cuban-American, lives in Florida, is so entitled and like has no pushback from the most disgusting foreign policy views.
Yeah. I remember watching Jake Tapper interview John Bolton, and he kind of like attacks Bolton from the right and comes at Bolton from the right and is like, are you sure this deal with Korea can be ironclad? Do you really trust the North Koreans? Do you really? And then the one question about Venezuela and Marco Rubio is like, Marco Rubio wants to do temporary protected status for Venezuelan exiles. Can you guarantee that? It's like Marco Rubio is the humanitarian in all of this, according to
Jake Tapper. Oh my God.
Jake
and he's
Tapper.
Trying to push Bolton to be firmer, tougher,
more
iron-fisted.
It's like, Mr. Cheney, can you really assure us that all Iraqi children will be drowned in a sea of blood? Come on.
Quit playing around. Oh my God, that's amazing. By the way, Elliot Abrams, I think the biggest nothing that Ilhan Omar said was anti-Semitic. The real anti-Semitism comes when people identify Elliot Abrams as a Jew. Like, if you care about Jews, stop saying that. That's a real liability for us.
Stop acknowledging that Elliot Abrams is a member of the tribe.
Yeah, we really want to play that down. Not
well, his wife would constantly remind us when she was alive that, you know, she was a big supporter of Israel who firmly believed in Palestinian genocide. And she had a blog called Bad Rachel. Rachel. Yeah. Naughty Rachel wants to murder the Palestinians who she called like demonic camel riders or something. And she said they teach their children, while Israeli children learn to play with transformers and play video games, Palestinian children learn to blow themselves up and worship Satan.
Right. Not even Allah. I thought it was Allah. I thought they'd go with the Allah line. Anyway,
Allah.
too learned, too soft.
Too much like God for her.
Yeah.
Too soft. Yeah. I'm just saying that was his wife. I mean, what do you think? You know, this is like their pillow talk.
Right.
Bad Rachel. This is Elliot Abrams.
Talk He's Rachel a big to me.
Talk bad Rachel. Let's talk about, you know, drowning Palestinian children in the tunnels of Gaza. It's like, this is who Elliot Abrams is. He's a member of the Israel lobby too. And Ilhan Omar's questioning of him over Venezuela, if you noticed, like, the reaction on Twitter, who was upset by it, was a lot of people who are affiliated with the Israel lobby.
And Think Progress. And Center for American Progress.
Oh, yeah, CAP.
Yeah.
Who was it there that was
upset? I forget her name, but there's one woman in who was
I've worked
with him.
Right, right. That's true. And she's at CAP. I mean, there you go. That's Neera Tanden's little Potemkin village.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing that Ilhan Omar, I mean, I think she's the bravest politician out there right now, because the fact that after getting called an anti-Semite twice, she went after Elliot Abrams and connected, you know, anyone who pretends that she just picks on Israel, it's so obvious she doesn't, because she talks about Saudi Arabia, she talks about Venezuela. Also, the whole idea of picking on Israel, you can't say that we have a special relationship with Israel all the time and then be like, why are you talking about Israel? Why are you talking about North Korea? Because we constantly say how much we hate North Korea. It's such a no-brainer. It's such a stupid argument. Yeah, I was pretty blown away by the fact that she went there.
She just made some really important comments about Obama.
Yeah.
That I think a lot of us really felt like Obama betrayed. I wasn't like that into him like everyone in 2008.
I remember. We were at the DNC together. That's
right.
When you were Team Hillary big time. I can't believe you it. Know, sorry, I don't mean to blow up your spot.
I just couldn't get it. I mean, Obama was the nominee, so I don't know how I was supporting Hillary, but...
You were like under your... I can take this out if you're too embarrassed by it. But you were definitely like not excited about him and felt like Hillary should have been the nominee.
I would say I was not excited about him, but, you know, as I watched him win the nomination and so on, I just couldn't get excited. I saw no evidence that he was going to be progressive.
Right.
And I kind of like had this impulse to stick it to all the Obamaites and I just thought, you know, if Hillary won, it would just be such a fun way of sticking it to them. It was kind of like being like a troll mentality, which I obviously abandoned in 2016 when I saw what she really was, was just a right-wing Democrat. But, and there were things about Obama that were, I don't know if there would have been an Iran deal if Hillary had been president. But but anyway, the point is that the Obama administration was a gigantic betrayal of everyone, and it helped lead to Trump, including the way he handled the economic collapse and so many other things. You know, my book that's coming out next month, I go into how his foreign policy helped set the stage for Trump. And Ilhan Omar basically said this in Politico. And then today I just saw that she tweeted audio of her interview saying, I'm a huge Obama fan. They got it wrong. And, you know, I don't understand the backpedaling, but she's still someone who's out there saying things that she basically has been like expressing a lot of the things that we've said, you know, you've said on your podcast that we've basically believed, but we never had anyone in federal government to convey our views in Congress or somewhere.
Right.
You know, you just had to settle for something.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So there's an impulse to defend her, and I think it's good because it's mobilized wider debate about AIPAC. It's shown, it's lifted the mask on the New York Times op-ed section. The mask keeps lifting in the Trump era.
Right.
It's tough to start having that effect and to take on mainstream media and call it the fake news media from the left.
Right.
And to take on the national security state from the left. And, you know, a lot of people I see saying, you know, she needs to go further and talk about the UN report on Israel's shooting of protesters in Gaza. She needs to do this. I think that the ultimate role she can play once this is over, assuming it blows over, is to push Bernie Sanders from the left and to be a effective surrogate for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's like, baby, it's hard for me to be too angry at her, or even I know lots of people are angry at Ocasio, but And we should push her too, but I guess I think we should push her in a way that's not quite as like, you're canceled.
You know, I could push Ocasio-Cortez a lot more if I was like a magazine editor of a glossy magazine, or if I had something to offer her on a congressional committee. But you know, she's not, I don't think she's as actually going to be as responsive to grassroots pressure, because she has some ambition for something much more. And Ilhan Omar just wants to represent her district, which is largely Somali American district, with a lot of people who've had her same experience and want her to manifest her experience as a refugee and as someone who's been in a district which has been under heavy FBI surveillance into political action.
So should we talk about our favorite, Meghan McCain?
Sure. I mean, I try to avoid talking about her, but she's just kind of forcing the issue.
Right.
It says, I mean, it says a lot about our country not being a democracy that Meghan McCain is being talked about by us.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, her father comes from a long line of military aristocracy, all the way back to George Washington's army. And they were made wealthy through their political elite and military connections. Her father was actually a terrible pilot who was shot down because of mistakes he made.
Right. That, I did love when Trump was like, look, for me, a hero, he doesn't get caught. It was kind of amazing to watch.
I, and a lot of people loved it. A lot of veterans loved it, especially Vietnam veterans. And McCain, he sang like a bird when he was in the Hanoi Hilton. He gave up locations of U.S. Navy. He gave advanced intelligence to Vietnamese interrogators. Then he returned with
that's
a congressional.
For the left.
Yeah. I mean, that's good for the Jane Fonda left.
Yeah.
You know, Hanoi Jane. But, you know, his he returned with a congressional seat just ready for him. In Arizona, and then a Senate seat. He was supported for years by the arms industry, by the extraction industry, and then he spent his career palling around with war criminals and Nazis, including jihadists in Syria and Libya. The guys who killed Gaddafi, Abdel Hakim Belhaj, the leader of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who was a longtime Al-Qaeda affiliate, got a special meeting in Benghazi with John McCain, where John McCain declared, they are not Al-Qaeda. John McCain went to Maidan Square in Ukraine in 2014 during the coup there that was taking place, and went on stage with Ole Tianbach, who is a straight-up neo-Nazi, to address the crowd. Tianbach has been he's been photographed Sieg Heiling. He's the founder of the Social National Party. Does that sound familiar to you? The National Socialist Party. The Nazi Party. It's modeled after the Nazi Party. He is also the co-founder with the Ukrainian politician who's now the head of the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada, named Andrei Poruby, of Patriot of Ukraine, which is a neo-Nazi militia. And Andrei Poruby was granted a special audience in Washington with John McCain in 2017. McCain even went to meet a Ukrainian far-right militia in the field in 2015. So the guy is like, I think there are more anti-Semitic incidents that John McCain has been involved in than Ilhan Omar.
Right.
But Meghan McCain, I don't know how you muster up tears for this. It's really weird.
First of all, I love the idea of her. I love the idea of her watching, you know, listening to Omar, to Ilhan Omar, and being like, oh, my God, I'm so triggered by the dual allegiance trope that I'm so well versed with. I know she's pretending. I know she's not claiming that she knew it, but once she learned about it, I guess. But I love the liberal.
I think
studies.
Everybody's pretending.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But everybody's pretending to be upset about it. It's all like this fake manufactured scandal because she said loyalty to a foreign country.
Allegiance.
People said, oh, well, let's say it's an anti-Semitic trope. It sounds like dual loyalty.
Right. It's funny because Jonathan, just really quickly, Jonathan Chait, who started this smear round three, he got the story from he linked to a story at Jewish Insider. He said Laura Kelly, which sounds like a Shiksa name. He didn't say Jewish Insider. Anyway, but her piece, actually, the headline of it was like, Omar and Tlaib talk about how accusations of anti-Semitism stifle discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or something like that. Her article was much more robust in what she quoted. I have a piece up at FAIR now on this, but of course, Jonathan Chait quoted one part of it. That's it.
Yeah, he missed, well, surprise. It's surprising that he missed.
I know.
I mean, I could go off on him,
right.
But, you know, that is the way that everybody's been reporting on it, which is to not quote what she's saying in order to perpetuate
And it's so
sense.
It's so meta because she said, one of the things she said is, no matter what we say, we're accused of being anti-Semitic to shut down a conversation. And of course, what happened is that she was accused of being anti-Semitic and no one has talked about important stories related to Israel this week.
Meghan McCain, I guess, wanted to kind of expose herself to the controversy and get in the limelight. It's something that she's done a lot because, I mean, she's famous for nothing. She's kind of like a war crimes Kardashians or something.
Right.
And it backfired because she's just such a self-parody.
Right.
She's such an obvious goyish or shiksa.
Yeah, she couldn't wear her shiksas and more on her sleeve. Yeah.
And she is just so obviously disingenuous in her outrage that it kind of exposed. It was like the opening we were waiting for to expose farce for what it was. But, you know, just back to my point about Meghan McCain, you know, why is she there at all? Why is she on The View? I mean, I don't know why The View is on, but why is she on The View? What has she done? I remember when she was breaking out as like this political personality, it was when the Daily Beast was launched and I was like one of their staff writers and she was just came on all of a sudden. And it was so obvious that what she was writing was ghostwritten and it was kind of like engineered by John McCain's team to make her into a public figure.
Right.
Then you watch her speech at McCain's funeral where she's like, she has this psychotic, rabid look on her face while she's like,
gets it from her dad.
Yes. Yeah. He fought in Vietnam too. The speech was so obviously written by Mark Salter, who is McCain's longtime
speechwriter. Oh my God. Yeah. Who called Bernie like a Castro loving fossil or something.
Right. Right. And
you seen him? He's not exactly a spring chicken. And neither was his boss.
Yeah. When you work for McCain and you help him comb his hair, like, you don't get to call other politicians fossils.
And it takes years off your life too.
Like Bernie can do a layup.
You know? I know. I want all these people who make fun of him to like challenge him to a basketball game, including Trump.
Oh yeah. So there's that too. Trump is not, I don't know what his physical condition is, but.
Bloat. And he looks like he has gout.
He has like, his face is like a goiter coming out of his neck. But anyway, so the McCain, I mean, she's just like, this comically conceived holographic facade of a decrepit, degenerate oligarchy that's been totally discredited. And now she cries about some comment about AIPAC. I mean, she's crying for AIPAC, which is like the most sociopathic institution. It's like what Allen Ginsberg was talking about in Howl when he talks about the Moloch. It's like, that's what it is. We don't even know. No one can name one AIPAC official, like an AIPAC staffer. That's what they are. Like, they don't even want us to know who they are. And so it's just like this farce. And then you have like her husband, this guy, Ben Dominich, who I remember when I used to work at Media Matters back in like the Bush era. He emerged as this kind of like right-wing boy one. This guy went down on multiple plagiarism, not charges. He was just a serial plagiarist who was ripping everybody off left and right to try to become this big right-wing columnist. He's reemerged with this publication, The Federalist, which, you know, seems to be pretty well-funded. I don't know if like it came through McCain's network. But, you know, they haven't had like the best record on writing about Jews there. Let's see. Here's a piece from 2016. We all know the stereotypes for Jewish women and girls: aggressive, demanding, pushy. Some might even say whiny. If you're a Jewish man, you've either given voice to these opinions or privately considered them while walking home after another argument or sitting in a restaurant feeling emasculated.
He's Jewish.
Ben Domenech, I don't know if he's Jewish, but this is on the website. Right. Let me see who it – let me see.
And either way, it sounds like projection.
It's by – oh, shit, this is interesting. It's by a guy named Joshua Seidel, who is the Jewish member of the alt-right, who's like a Jewish white supremacist.
Oh, nice.
Who would troll me a lot.
So that was on Ben Domenech's website, but he didn't write
Federalist.
It. Yeah, got it.
No, he didn't write it. But someone apparently even more unsavory than him, Joshua Seidel, wrote it, who's like a follower of Richard Spencer, wrote it. So basically like the Jewish guy in the white hood, you know, he wears a kippah under his white hood. Like he's like, let's just burn crosses on black people's lawns.
Right.
That's who wrote it. And it seems like he doesn't like Jewish women. I don't know. I mean, we could like make those jokes ourselves.
It's just, but it's like a little different when you're writing in a right wing publication.
I know plenty of, you know, non-Jewish women and people who act like that. So anyway, it definitely had an MRA tone to it as well. But the point is, like, clean up your own house. Then there's Pastor Hagee. We haven't even gotten into Pastor Hagee.
I miss him. From there's the spotlight.
I miss Pastor Hagee a lot. He's really entertaining.
I know.
He's like this rotund figure.
He's adorable, kind of.
He's like a cross between like Elmer Gantry and the Penguin and some Edward G. Robinson style villain. He's definitely like would be better in a black and white film as like he looks like a cartoon character. He's a faith healing Pentecostal preacher from Cornerstone Church in San Antonio whose endorsement John McCain happily accepted in 2008, because McCain always had a problem with the Christian right.
Yeah, what is his religion?
The thing is, McCain is not evangelical.
Right.
And you either have to be evangelical or you have to just be a right-wing psychopath, draconian fire breather like Trump to get the Christian right to support you. Basically, you just have to tell them I'm going to appoint like extreme anti-abortion people to the courts like Trump did.
Yeah.
And McCain always had this relationship with the Christian right in Arizona and in Congress where he just didn't always want their people to be on the federal bench.
He wasn't an accomplished enough war criminal, I think. For the Christian if he had killed more blood in his hands, maybe.
That's why Hagee endorsed him, because Hagee was there to like have war in Iran.
Right.
McCain was going to do that, or so he thought.
Right.
So anyway, McCain was like, yeah, finally I got one of these nut jobs on my team. Problem was that Hagee really was a member of the Christian right who believed that the Antichrist was Jewish. And I found this sermon. I mean, the sermons of Hagee, they're just pure gold. Like every single one of them is just outlandish. And this one, he said, when the Antichrist returns, when the Antichrist returns, he will be homosexual and half Jewish as Hitler was with fierce features.
Right.
Then he added with fierce features. It's like he's going to be fierce. The
sounds like maybe he has a crush on him.
It was very vivid, and I don't know. I wrote about it at the Huffington Post when they used to allow anybody to write anything there, and it was like writing on the bathroom wall, and it had a big impact, along with the other comments that Hagee had made about Hitler being a hunter and Herzl being a fisher. And how they work together to bring the Jews to Israel to fulfill biblical prophecy. So kind of like the Holocaust being a good thing. And then McCain decided to rescind the endorsement of Hagee.
Right.
But he was, you know, this was all out there and he knew about it.
It just wasn't in the media. It hadn't been broken as a story yet.
Right. Right. And that's actually, by the way, I mean, we did all this work at the Huffington Post and any other site that would let us put our research on it. And that's back when like MSNBC would cover the Christian right as an actual scourge in society. So it was, I think, Keith Olbermann who kind of made a big, furor about that.
Now he just doesn't have the luxury.
No pun intended.
I know, exactly. But he just doesn't have the luxury with Russia stuff, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
we got to report on that 24/7 because.
Remember Keith Olbermann, like right after Trump's election, those weird rants he would do in his basement.
Were they for GQ or something? He'd be like rapping the flag.
I'm Keith Olbermann and this is The Resistance.
And then he'd be like, resist!
Resist. Remove. Peace.
No one even remembers how crazy that moment was. And he'll, and then they had that woman on Saturday Night Live dressed as Hillary Clinton singing Leonard Cohen.
Oh my God, Kate McKinnon, that's a repressed memory. Yeah. I need a trigger warning for that.
Hallelujah. I'm not giving up, and neither should you. And live from New York, it's Saturday night.
That was amazing.
Yeah,
oh
yeah.
Oh, my God.
I just knew after Hillary lost, something crazy was going to happen, and it
did.
That's
one of the many
things,
yeah.
We're seeing that chapter close. So I'm happy anyway that this debate took place about AIPAC.
Yeah.
I think they lost in a way.
Also, I think so. Also, but really quickly, she cried because she did. You saw the video of her, right? Of Megan?
I actually haven't
oh,
seen
can
it.
We
I
watch
didn't,
it.
I didn't know there was. I didn't know it was real. I just was like,
oh no. Yeah, can I? Yeah, can we watch can it? Yeah. Hold on. Yeah. I can screen share. I think with you. Let's see. And it's amazing because well, I don't want to give it away too much, but she also the interaction between Meghan McCain and this woman of color who's actually Jewish, Sunny.
I don't watch this shit.
Me neither. But now I'm a big Sunny fan. One second.
Sunny.
Hold on.
Yeah, Sunny.
One second.
Woo! Woo! Why do people do that? Do you do that?
What do you mean?
You know when you're happy about something in
yeah.
public? It's like a show or something. Do you go, woo!
I mean, if I'm at an event, maybe.
I can't muster that noise inside myself.
Did the mentioning The View make you think of that?
Just cheering for Sunny, you know, from the live studio audience. Woo!
Okay, here it is. Let's see.
I'm just looking at Megan McCain called Ellie Valley, the Jewish cartoonist, an anti-Semite now.
Also, how bad are you at Judar if you don't know Ellie Valley is Jewish?
I know.
I mean, the name also, yeah.
He's like one of the most Jewish people I know.
I know.
I don't think he'll be offended by that.
No, me neither,
just,
yeah.
One of the people I can just confidently say is more Jewish than me.
It's okay. I just sent it to you.
All right. Meghan McCain breaks down in tears. Oh, they got Abby Huntsman on there too. Why is Abby another more proof that we don't live in a democracy.
Right. We're terrorized by these totally unaccomplished media created charisma-free daughters of Republicans.
Some right of center fail daughters.
Yeah. But they're like, their thing is that they like gay people. So they're like fun and woke.
They have gay friends.
Yeah.
I hate
she
that.
Also like Megan.
When people, they're like, you know what? I would have burned a cross, but I met a black person
right.
I liked. So I'm not going to do it. Hold on. I'm watching this.
This issue is a really intense one for me. And just bear with me, because I know, Sunny, you and I in particular don't always agree on
By
this.
By the way, she's partly Jewish, that woman, the black woman, Sunny.
And I will tell you, I take this very personally as a woman of color who has, you know, been the subject of so much bigotry. And what a lot of people don't know is that my grandfather is Jewish. He is a Sephardic Jew. I've experienced firsthand in my family anti-Semitism and bigotry for being black. And so this whole, you know, thing, I think it's just a distraction.
And she says, like, I'm Jewish, my family's faced anti-Semitism. And Meghan McCain is just like, okay, are you comfortable with my talking again, Joy?
Are you comfortable with me speaking now? So, are we comfortable with me rebutting now?
Yes.
I want to say first and foremost, anti-Semitism shouldn't be a left or right issue. I don't think we should be politicizing it on either side because, as we know, if it's a tiki torch person in Charlottesville saying Jews will not replace us, or if it's the, right. We had Barry Weiss on to talk about sort of these more dog whistle moments that, in my view, Ilhan Omar is doing. A lot of Jewish people in this country, I think, are being asked, with the rise of anti-Semitism in this country, is it more important to defend party politics or is it more important to defend anti-Semitism? And we can have conversations all day long about how you feel about Israeli politics. Yes, excuse me, if you object to it. Mm-hmm. We can have a conversation all day long about how you feel about Palestinian politics, how you feel about Israeli politics, how you feel about Netanyahu. But in the same way that I fear what's happening with Corbyn in the UK, I fear that it's seeping its way over here in the United States.
Yeah. I think we should talk about the comment that she made that has spurned all of this discussion.
Yes, Sunny.
right? She said when we had Barry Weiss on as an expert in what is anti-Semitic and what isn't, I asked her, is it okay to talk about Israel's policies and not be called anti-Semitic?
She said
and
yes.
And she said yes. She said where it crosses the line is when you say that Israel does not have the right to exist, that that is when it crosses the line. Now, Omar has never suggested that Israel does not have the right to exist.
But can I say what she has said?
So remember that Ilhan Omar in the West Virginia Republican Party just had this huge poster superimposed with her face with 9/11 terrorists. And I haven't heard any outrage about that coming from the Republican Party.
You have to admit, Megan, that it is disingenuous of the Republican Party to go after her. This is her point when they are backing a president who is in bed with dictators committing human rights violations.
Really,
all over.
Wait, what? What's the lady on the lady on the left?
You mean physically? She's not Jewish, Joy Behar. Isn't that hilarious?
Joy Behar? I always thought she was Jewish.
Everyone thinks that she's Italian.
Okay, well, her retort was, this president is in bed with dictators? Like, how is that? I thought she was going to say in bed with white supremacists,
right.
Which would have been. But what does that have to do with anything?
Just
it's
general
like saying he's
problems.
In bed with Wall Street.
Like, except Wall Street has the Jew thing, so that would have been problematic.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
That would have been bad.
But yeah, this is the best part.
I take this very personally. I would go so far as to say I probably verge on being a Zionist as well. But I will say that I don't have family that is Jewish, but Joe Lieberman
damn right
and Doss
you
Lieberman are my family.
Yeah.
And
oh, man, I
take
this.
The
this
hate
so good.
Crimes rising in this country incredibly seriously, and I think what's happening in Europe is really scary. And I'm sorry if I'm getting emotional,
you're right.
The idea that this is politicized, I'm really not. I was very nervous to talk about this on the show, and just because I don't technically have Jewish family that are blood related to me, it doesn't mean I don't take this as seriously, and it is very dangerous. Very dangerous. And I think we all collectively as Americans on both sides, and what Ilhan Omar is saying is very scary to me, and it's very scary to a lot of people, and I don't think you have to be Jewish to recognize
that. You don't.
That.
I'm tired of the selective outrage, and I hope that we have a joint resolution, perhaps, from Republicans and from the Democrats.
I was waiting for the crowd to erupt when Meghan McCain did her little performance, and they didn't.
Right.
It was just kind of like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like,
also,
she's talking about AIPAC.
And also, she's talking about the Liebermans, who is like, all these people are totally cool with interacting with anti-Semites. Like, Joe Lieberman would appear with Hagee.
He called Hagee an Ish Elohim.
Oh my God, that's the Moses, right? A prophet?
Yeah, like Moses.
I want to take the liberty of describing Pastor Hagee in the words that the Torah uses to describe Moses. He is an Ish Elohim, a man of God. And those words really do fit.
And I mean, and then you have like Netanyahu, who goes to Poland, and they were trying to pass a law in Poland that said you could be sued for saying the Polish had something to do with the Holocaust. Like, the Polish people were complicit in the Holocaust. They want to make that a suable offense. And then Netanyahu pushed back on it. And the Polish guy was like really upset, the prime minister, and was like,
well,
Polish people were complicit. Jews were complicit, which is hilarious.
First, Israel signed a memorandum of understanding with the Polish government that they would not protest that law, and then it became an issue.
Right.
So, because they want the military cooperation, the arms sales, and all of that, and also, you know, the EU is a problem for Israel.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm glad Meghan McCain thought that that was an appropriate thing to do. She doesn't obviously have much capacity for self-reflection. She doesn't exactly have her finger on the pulse of where things are.
Right.
And it exposed the manufactured outrage for the farce that it is, that someone would actually attempt to cry because they knew Joe and Hadassah Lieberman. And they're really – I think that she killed the Joe-mentum behind the attack on Ilhan Omar, or it was already dead.
Yeah.
Because you had that joint resolution that Omar voted for – What they really wanted to do, what AIPAC really wanted to do, was get her off the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House.
Right.
She is on a committee, a foreign relations committee, that will be in charge of what happens globally with our diplomacy. I'm uncomfortable with that in the same way that I was uncomfortable with Steve King being on that.
Well, Elliot Engel wanted to get rid of her, and that failed. So I think it was a defeat for AIPAC.
Yeah,
I think that we should pay attention to what's happening in the UK. I just did an interview
have you on, talk about that too.
Yeah, I just did an interview with Mr. Topple at the Canary. The Canary is one of the best websites to follow from the UK if you want to know what's happening around the attempts to basically dislodge Jeremy Corbyn and how the movement behind him is fighting back.
Right.
But it's all – they've manufactured this gigantic anti-Semitism scandal. By they, I mean the pro-Israel lobby in the UK and the Blairite elements within Labour. The Labour Party is splitting, and it's important because I know a lot of your viewers are really into Bernie Sanders, and a lot of them were galvanized by his 2016 campaign. This will be done to Bernie Sanders, who's Jewish, without any shame.
Right. Yeah, like, they're already pretending he's not a real Jew.
Yeah. And it's just going to – it's going to get to – there will be a Meghan McCain moment around Bernie where somebody calls him an anti-Semite and exposes – it brings out the farce and, like, it forces the contradictions into the open.
Yeah, you sound like such a Marxist. You know who did that is this guy, Mr. Dane, who's part of this resistance network online, who called Bernie Sanders a fake fucking Jew. And then Isaiah Breen, is that his name, who used to work for Keith Ellison?
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, that's anti-Semitic. And then he does the classic resistance bot move where he goes, I'm a black gay rape victim. You will not accuse me of that. And then they do this thing where it's like, I'm not an anti-Semite just because I criticize Bernie. It's like, no, you're an anti-Semite because you said he's a fake fucking Jew.
Well, it's just the worst form of anti-Semitism is when Gentiles decide to come in and determine who's a Jew and who isn't. But...
Right. What about do you know Tom Watson at all, by the way? He's my favorite figure from the resistance. He's such a passive-aggressive tool.
Well, there are two of them. There's also a really malicious Tom Watson in the UK who's the deputy chair of Labour, who's playing that role within the Labour Party as this little worm.
He's a worm, anyway. Tom Watson. Tom Watson constantly tweets about how bad Corbyn is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I thought that, like, given that Theresa May was on the other side, it would just – the optics would be too bad, but apparently not.
Well, this is the other thing I was going to say, which I just made this point with the Canary, is that Tony Blair has said that he would prefer – Jeremy Corbyn to lose than for Labour to win.
Right.
And this is how Bernie Sanders, if he gets the nomination, will be treated.
I've said this the exact same thing on many occasions. I keep saying there are Democrats who would rather Bernie lose the primary and then have a Democrat lose to Trump than Bernie win both.
Yeah.
It's 100% true.
So we're just going to have to watch that play out. And, you know, it's important for it to play out, because if somehow he or Corbyn triumphs, it's the biggest repudiation to media and the kind of centrist political class's ability to shape the parameters of debate and to serve as gatekeepers.
Yeah.
And, you know, Trump represented that in many ways, but he also represents the oligarchy.
Right.
So it's not this final repudiation.
Right. It's a pseudo repudiation.
And then we'll see them try to actually undermine whatever exists of democracy,
right,
to just end democracy as we know it. I call them the emergency rule centrists, like Emmanuel Macron.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and if one of them gets in power in the UK, you're going to have like a yellow vest movement there, and they'll have emergency rule, and like they don't govern by consent.
Yeah.
They can't anymore because they've been discredited.
Right.
So all they can do is create... delay the inevitable, which is some kind of left populism emerging to counter the right populism.
Right, which is
that's
the only way
mainstream.
You beat it. The only way you beat it.
Right.
No, you beat it with moderates, idiots. Can you do the Israel lobby in 2 minutes?
The Israel lobby is a constellation of groups and individuals that aims to dominate American politics and culture in order to preserve and perpetuate the special relationship between the U.S. and Israel, which guarantees Israel $4 billion in U.S. loans to purchase weapons from the United States and its arms manufacturers, as well as total diplomatic protection at the U.N. and within in the EU and Brussels. It uses a mixture of carrots and sticks to punish critics, driving them out of everything from, you know, city council positions to, you know, school board positions to Senate seats. And the carrots take the form of campaign funding, which was doled out to the tune of $15 million last year by pro-Israel organizations and donors. The largest donor to the Democratic Party as an individual is Haim Saban, who said he's a one-issue guy and his issue is Israel. And the largest individual donor to the Republican Party is Sheldon Adelson, who plays the same exact role and is also the key patron of Benjamin Netanyahu's political career. The Israel lobby's main arm is AIPAC, which is not registered as a foreign agent under the Justice Department, as all other foreign lobbies are, and that allows it a level of an exemption from the transparency that FARA guarantees us with other foreign lobbying groups. So we don't actually know which journalists it's meeting with, which politicians it's meeting with, or what the full extent of its activities are. But it is acting on behalf of a foreign apartheid state that has enacted a program of the continuous dispossession of an indigenous population. And those who criticize the Israel lobby should keep their focus on that and on what Israel is doing, because that's what the Israel lobby aims to prevent us from doing, from having that discussion and debate in our inside the institutions of our society.
What do you say to people who say, oh, but AIPAC doesn't donate any money?
Yeah, what they do is they have stealth packs that they set up at the state level, Delaware Valley PAC, which do donate money, as well as their cadre of donors who seek to skirt campaign finance laws by getting together at parties and throwing their credit cards in a hat, right, and then swiping the credit cards for $2,700, which is the maximum individual limit, or having people like Haim Saban donate to pro-Obama super PACs or pro-Clinton super PACs. So, of course, they donate money. It's just AIPAC doesn't do so directly. But if someone explained to me why it's consistently ranked the number two most powerful lobby in Washington behind the NRA, or why its office building on 2nd Street and H Street in Northeast is such a giant towering complex. They have a lot of money,
right,
and they know what to do with it. So it isn't all about the Benjamins. That's part of it. But Ilhan Omar definitely hit on one of the most kind of inconvenient truths of pro-Israel support in the United States, which is that it is not organic. And that's why you have the Christian Zionist movement being incorporated into the Israel lobby, because the Israel lobby is so top heavy. It consists of lobbyists and then a sector of Jewish population. We're 3.5% of the American public. So they call the Christian Zionists their safety belt in the Bible Belt. And they've recruited them heavily. AIPAC actually helped set up Hagee's Christians United for Israel organization. And what they represent is the future of pro-Israel support in the U.S. Old, right-wing, you know, white nationalist, settler colonial-minded, apocalypse, rapture-ready. And that's not a good thing for Israel, which is in the Israel lobby, which has always counted on bipartisan support, you know.
Right.
And our generation of Jews has helped drive this, break the consensus within the Democratic Party's base. And the problem is that the Democratic Party is not democratic enough to embrace the change that's happening at the grassroots level. So that's what we need to do next.
And what does the rapture require from us?
The ingathering of the exiles, which means we have to move to greater Israel, which can be defined as anywhere, not just between the river and the sea, but biblical Israel is anywhere between Egypt and Jordan. Then that was the original map of Israel as outlined by Herzl through the Jewish National Fund. So we got to go there, probably not to Cairo. They probably want us in Jerusalem, where Pastor Hagee leads these tours of the Hill of Megiddo, where Christ will descend on his white throne. And then if we fail to convert, and that doesn't mean just being a Christian like the Palestinian Christians who Pastor Hagee's people think are akin to Satan. We have to be born again in the blood of the Lamb and be evangelical Christians to avoid burning in an everlasting lake of fire.
Right. When I cut you off.
I mean, I always say, like, I'm looking forward to the rapture because all those people will be out of my face.
Right.
Not that I am against all evangelical Christians, right. But I mean, like, the Hagee people who, like, sit around watching Fox News and deriving this weird libidinal satisfaction from obsessing over Ilhan Omar and AOC.
Don't we also there are a certain number of us can't, even if we all got on board, there's a certain...
144,000.
Are what?
Will be saved.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I don't know what role we're going to play in the heavens, but right. 144,000. But the rest burn in an everlasting lake of fire. But I've always said, you know, if that doesn't happen, I'll take, you know, Hagee's RV, right. His like Winnebago or whatever. He has like a pretty nice house right. In Texas.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's their end goal. And the way that the Israel lobbyists and Israel supporters have justified it to me is they say, well, we know it's not going to happen, so why should we care?
Right, exactly. It's totally cynical and opportunistic.
Yeah.
Which can't be said of their alliances with Hungary, with right-wing governments in Poland and Hungary, where neo-Nazism is actually on the rise.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, did they follow the Polish Independence Day ceremony? It wasn't like... It wasn't exactly a Jew-friendly
right.
zone.
Right. What is the future of Israel? And what do you say to people who say, oh, but Israel's a democracy. How could you say it's an apartheid state?
Well, the future of Israel is militarism and right-wing demagogy, a one-state reality where the majority of the population is Palestinian living behind a combination of walls, sophisticated surveillance mechanisms, underneath drones, and inside a series of cantons and fortified ghettos, who are, the majority of the population, who have no rights and no freedom of movement, and are denied all protections under the Geneva Conventions. Therefore, you have an apartheid state, because the two-state solution never happened. We're in a one-state reality. So the question is, what kind of state will that be? Will it be an apartheid state, or will it be a binational state where all of its residents have equality? It's just sort of hard to deny that Israel's an apartheid state at this point. Also, when it passes laws through its Knesset, like the nation state
law. I didn't know that until Juan Cole mentioned it the other day.
Yeah, where they formalize the second-class status of Palestinian citizens of Israel, who actually enjoy sort of like fourth-class status, remove Arabic as an official language, which was the language of the land
right.
before Israel existed, and essentially set the stage for annexation of the West Bank, because this law makes it clear that if the West Bank is annexed, those Palestinians who are brought into Israel in a formal sense cannot have the right to vote. They cannot declare one person one vote, because this law was already passed. And this law was passed in what is supposed to be Israel's democratic body.
In a country which is supposed to be the only democracy in the Middle East.
It's clearly not the – even if it were a democracy, it wouldn't be the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, Tunisia is technically a democracy. Turkey is not – it's not like a very democratic country, but it's sort of technically functions along democratic lines. So anyway, I think everybody watching this rejects the idea of Israel as a democracy.
Yeah.
But I always have – ever since I started to get woke on the issue.
Right.
And, you know, I wrote this book, Goliath, in 2013 about Israel's permanent right-wing future, the rise of fascism in Israel and the mainstreaming of fascism.
Right.
And I, feel like looking at the situation today politically, It was almost like I went soft.
Yeah, exactly. You didn't get how bad it would be. Tony Judt, the historian who died, I remember when I think he wrote something in the New York Review of Books or London Review of Books, said that he thought that Netanyahu's election was going to end the kind of liberal Jewish consensus and support of Israel because he was so right wing. But he was wrong, obviously.
Yeah. There was this attempt to reframe Netanyahu as a, you know, maybe he'll make peace.
Oh, right. Because it requires someone like that, right?
Right.
To do it. Because if a leftist in Israel, they won't have the support, blah, blah.
It's like Nixon going to China,
right.
Even though Nixon was actually going to China to divide China and the Soviet Union. But anyway, that didn't happen. Netanyahu was Netanyahu.
Right. Netanyahu's going to Netanyahu.
If it walks like a Netanyahu and talks like, you know.
Yeah, which is scary. His voice is scary.
And it's
and so sinister.
And if it says that, you know, he owns the land because he bought a ring at a Jerusalem pawn shop that says Netanyahu, which actually just means he was here and denies that his family's real name was Milikovsky, then it's a Netanyahu.
I didn't know that story. That's interesting.
When John Boehner brought him in, it's like, I'm a used car salesman coming to speak to all these stupid guys.
Right.
And I'm going to tell them this crazy story about how I found a ring.
In my office, I have a signet ring that was loaned to me by Israel's Department of Antiquities. This ring was found right next to the Western Wall, but it dates back 2,800 years ago, 200 years after King David declared Jerusalem as our people's capital. Now, this ring is a seal of a Jewish official, and his name is inscribed in it, on it, in Hebrew. The name is Netanyahu, Netanyahu ben Yoash. Now that's my last name. My first name, Benjamin, dates back 1,000 years earlier to Benjamin, the son of Jacob. One of Benjamin's brothers was named Shimon, which also happens to be the name of my good friend Shimon Peres, the president of Israel. You see, nearly 4,000 years ago, Benjamin, Shimon, and their 10 brothers roamed the hills of Judea. Ladies and gentlemen, the connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel cannot be denied. The connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem cannot be denied.
And George Will wrote it up and was like, Netanyahu in his office has a ring.
Oh my God.
It is 3,000 years old from the Roman Empire, and it says Netanyahu.
That's amazing.
Like, he was just there. BB was just there. Actually, he was from Lithuania. And he probably has more connection to Sarah Palin's family,
right,
which is said to be Lithuanian Jews, than he does.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She has supposedly Lithuanian Jewish ancestry.
That's amazing. He also, there's video footage of him saying that the Americans can be moved.
Oh, yeah. America's
yeah.
You know, he meant AIPAC.
Right.
Like, America is a thing you can easily move.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is great. Awesome.
Thanks for having me.
Max Blumenthal. Everyone follow him. Yeah, well, I'll have you on again to talk about your book. I have to read it.
Thanks.
But, yeah.
I'll look forward to that.
We should do a live event.
We should. We'll do it.
All right.
Moderate Rebels.
Oh, yeah.
Collaboration.
Oh, yeah. And then Ben will be like, hola, hola, en los Estados Unidos. I just made him sound like Argentine, though. That's not really fair.
All right. Peace.
Bye. In the Middle East. You can follow Max's work on Twitter at Max Blumenthal or at his website, The Gray Zone. He also is the co-host with Ben Norton of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist and the author of several books, including best-selling Republican Gomorrah, Goliath, The 51-Day War, and The Management of Savagery. He has produced print articles for an array of publications, many video reports, and several documentaries, including Killing Gaza. Blumenthal founded The Gray Zone in 2015 to shine a journalistic light on America's state of perpetual war and its dangerous domestic repercussions. You can follow me on Twitter at KT House. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. The Katie Halpert Show is edited by Ted Reedy. Music is by the band Cordova.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.